Chapter 140. And I looked full at him, but it went no farther that night. Apostrophe, he stopped once more, and was silent for so long an interval, that John Westlock said go on. Apostrophe Martin had never removed his eyes from his face, but was so absorbed in horror and astonishment, that he could not speak. It may have been a week after that, or it may have been less or more, the matter was in my mind all the time, but I cannot recollect the time, as I should any other period, when he spoke to me again. We were alone then too, being there before the usual hour of assembling. There was no appointment between us, but I think I went there to meet him, and I know he came there to meet me. He was there first. He was reading a newspaper when I went in, and nodded to me without looking up, or leaving off reading. I sat down opposite and close to him. He said, immediately, that he wanted me to get him some of two sorts of drugs. One that was instantaneous in its effect, of which he wanted very little. One that was slow, and not suspicious in appearance, of which he wanted more. While he was speaking to me, he still read the newspaper. He said, drugs, and never used any other word. Neither did one. Apostrophe, this all agrees with what I have heard before, apostrophe observed John Westlock. I asked him what he wanted the drugs for. He said for no harm, to physic cats, what did it matter to me? I was going out to a distant colony. I had recently got the appointment, which, as Mr. Westlock knows, I have since lost by my sickness, and which was my only hope of salvation from ruin, and what did it matter to me? He could get them without my aid at half a hundred places, but not so easily as he could get them of me. This was true. He might not want them at all, he said, and he had no present idea of using them, but he wished to have them by him. All this time he still read the newspaper. We talked about the price. He was to forgive me a small debt I was quite in his power, and to pay me £5, and there the matter dropped, through others coming in. But, next night, under exactly similar circumstances, I gave him the drugs, on his saying I was a fool to think that he should ever use them for any harm, and he gave me the money. We have never met since. I only know that the poor old father died soon afterwards, just as he would have died from this cause, and that I have undergone, and suffer now, intolerable misery. Nothing, he added, stretching out his hands, can paint my misery. It is well deserved, but nothing can paint it. Apostrophe, with that he hung his head, and said no more, wasted and wretched. He was not a creature upon whom to heap reproaches that were unavailing. Let him remain at hand, apostrophe said Martin, turning from him, but out of sight, in heaven's name. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he will remain here, apostrophe John whispered. Come with me. Apostrophe, softly turning the key upon him as they went out, he conducted Martin into the adjoining room, in which they had been before. Martin was so amazed, so shocked, and confounded by what he had heard, that it was some time before he could reduce it to any order in his mind, or could sufficiently comprehend the bearing of one part upon another, to take in all the details at one view. When he, at length, had the whole narrative clearly before him, John Westlock went on to point out the great probability of the guilt of Jonas being known to other people, who traded in it for their own benefit, and who were, by such means, able to exert that control over him which Tom Pinch had accidentally witnessed, and unconsciously assisted. This appeared so plain, that they agreed upon it without difficulty. But instead of deriving the least assistance from this source, they found that it embarrassed them the more. They knew nothing of the real parties who possessed this power. The only person before them was Tom's landlord. They had no right to question Tom's landlord, even if they could find him, which, according to Tom's account, it would not be easy to do. And granting that they did question him, and he answered, which was taking a good deal for granted, he had only to say, with reference to the adventure on the wharf, that he had been sent from such and such a place, to summon Jonas back on urgent business, and there was an end of it. Besides, there was the great difficulty and responsibility of moving at all in the matter. Lusum's story might be false, and his wretched state it might be greatly heightened by a diseased brain, or admitting it to be entirely true, the old man might have died a natural death. Mr. Pecksniff had been there at the time, as Tom immediately remembered, when he came back in the afternoon, and shared their counsels, and there had been no secrecy about it. Martin's grandfather was of right the person to decide upon the course that should be taken, but to get at his views would be impossible, for Mr. Pecksniff's views were certain to be his, and the nature of Mr. Pecksniff's views in reference to his own son-in-law might be easily reckoned upon. Apart from these considerations, Martin could not endure the thought of seeming to grasp at this unnatural charge against his relative, and using it as a stepping stone to his grandfather's favor. But that he would seem to do so, if he presented himself before his grandfather in Mr. Pecksniff's house again, for the purpose of declaring it, and that Mr. Pecksniff, of all men, would represent his conduct in that despicable light, he perfectly well knew. On the other hand, to be in possession of such a statement, and take no measures of further inquiry in reference to it, was tantamount to being a partner in the guilt it professed to disclose. In a word, they were wholly unable to discover any outlet from this maze of difficulty, which did not lie through some perplexed and entangled thicket. And although Mr. Tapley was promptly taken into their confidence, and the fertile imagination of that gentleman suggested many bold expedients, which, to do him justice, he was quite ready to carry into instant operation on his own personal responsibility, still bating the general zeal of Mr. Tapley's nature, nothing was made particularly clear by these offers of service. It was in this position of affairs that Tom's account of the strange behavior of the decayed clerk on the night of the tea party became of great moment, and finally convinced them that to arrive at a more accurate knowledge of the workings of that old man's mind and memory would be to take a most important stride in their pursuit of the truth. So, having first satisfied themselves that no communication had ever taken place between Lusum and Mr. Chuffey which would have accounted at once for any suspicions the latter might entertain, they unanimously resolved that the old clerk was the man they wanted. But, like the unanimous resolution of a public meeting, which will oftentimes declare that this or that grievance is not to be borne a moment longer, which is nevertheless borne for a century or two afterwards, without any modification, they only reached in this the conclusion that they were all of one mind. For it was one thing to want Mr. Chuffey, and another thing to get at him, and to do that without alarming him, or without alarming Jonas, or without being discomfited by the difficulty of striking, in an instrument so out of tune and so unused, the note they sought, was an end as far from their reach as ever. The question then became, who of those about the old clerk, had most influence with him that night? Tom said his young mistress clearly. But Tom and all of them shrunk from the thought of entrapping her, and making her the innocent means of bringing retribution on her cruel husband. Was there nobody else? Why, yes. In a very different way, Tom said, he was influenced by Mrs. Gamp, the nurse, who had once had the control of him, as he understood, for some time. They caught at this immediately. Here was a new way out, developed in a quarter until then overlooked. John Westlock knew Mrs. Gamp. He had given her employment. He was acquainted with her place of residence. For that good lady had obligingly furnished him, at parting, with a pack of her professional cards for general distribution. It was decided that Mrs. Gamp should be approached with caution, but approached without delay, and that the depths of that discreet matron's knowledge of Mr. Chuffey, and means of bringing them, or one of them, into communication with him, should be carefully sounded. On this service, Martin and John Westlock determined to proceed that night, waiting on Mrs. Gamp first, at her lodgings, and taking their chance of finding her in the repose of private life, or of having to seek her out elsewhere in the exercise of her professional duties. Tom returned home, that he might lose no opportunity of having an interview with Nadgett, by being absent in the event of his reappearance. And Mr. Tapley remained, by his own particular desire, for the time being in Furnival's Inn, to look after Lucem, who might safely have been left to himself, however, for any thought he seemed to entertain of giving them the slip. Before they parted on their several errands, they caused him to read aloud, in the presence of them all, the paper which he had about him, and the declaration he had attached to it, which was to the effect that he had written it voluntarily, in the fear of death, and in the torture of his mind. And when he had done so, they all signed it, and taking it from him, of his free will, locked it in a place of safety. Martin also wrote, by John's advice, a letter to the trustees of the famous grammar school, boldly claiming the successful design as his, and charging Mr. Pecksniff with the fraud he had committed. In this proceeding also, John was oddly interested, observing, with his usual irreverence, that Mr. Pecksniff had been a successful rascal all his life through, and that it would be a lasting source of happiness to him, John, if he could help to do him justice in the smallest particular. A busy day. But Martin had no lodgings yet, so when these matters were disposed of, he excused himself from dining with John Westlock, and was fain to wander out alone, and look for some. He succeeded, after great trouble, in engaging two garrets for himself and Mark, situated in a court in the Strand, not far from Temple Bar. Their luggage, which was waiting for them at a coach office, he conveyed to this new place of refuge, and it was with a glow of satisfaction, which as a selfish man he never could have known and never had, that, thinking how much pains and trouble he had saved Mark, and how pleased and astonished Mark would be, he afterwards walked up and down, in the temple, eating a meat pie for his dinner. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.